You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Well, it's going to be hard to troll on in this week because we are like thousands of miles away. Not really. But we are talking about things that happen thousands of miles away, certainly hundreds of miles away. Last week, we were chatting with Asuka Ishizaki. She is the protected species coordinator for the council and has been on our program many times over the years. And last week, we talked a little bit about what was going on with the interaction between seabirds, particularly a couple of types of albatross, and our longline fishery. Now, as you know, on the council, we talk about a lot of things, not just the longliners. But this week, and last week, we are, because it's a very important part of what the council's duties are, is to get in and help figure out what's going on in the ocean and how everybody can share in the bounty and also protect future generations and fisheries and everything else. So that's what this is all about. And when I met Asuka years back, it was about turtles, because she's like the turtle lady. And there's also turtle guys. And there have been this fascination with these things, and the jury's still out on whether we should be eating them again in the main islands and all that. But today, Asuka's here to talk about something different. The loggerhead turtle research. Now, what are loggerheads? And we're going to find out what the research is all about. But first, nice to see you again.
Well, thanks for having me back.
And you love turtles, right?
I do.
You love all endangered species. But and just for those who don't know, today we're going to talk about the loggerhead turtle. Ballpark, how many different turtles are there around us in the Pacific? We know about the green sea turtle, right?
Yep.
We know about the loggerhead.
We also have the hawksbills, which is another green one that nests here.
Yeah.
And then we don't really see them close by, but farther offshore in the waters, we have the leatherbacks and the olive ridley turtles.
Okay, now the leatherbacks, which we're going to talk a little bit about today. I mean, loggerheads are different from the leatherbacks. Leatherbacks actually have kind of soft... It's not like a turtle shell, right? It's like
they
leather.
They have a leathery...
Leatherhead.
Name suggests it's like a leathery shell, and their skin is also a lot rubberier and leatherier, if that's a word, than some of the other turtles.
And we'll talk about that, too, a little bit. But today, now, loggerhead is not named loggerhead because it has a wooden head, a log head. How did that name come up?
Well, they kind of do have a big, bulkier head than some of the other, like the Hono does, because they primarily eat crustaceans and harder, animals that require a lot of jaw movement.
Okay, and now so, as soon as you say crustaceans, you're really looking at something that probably is foraging underwater.
Yes, and they're once they're adults and they're really become these crustacean eating or, you know, these... critters, they're, you know, more coastal. So when we see them around Hawaii and offshore of Hawaii and our longline fishery, we're talking about the more juvenile stages, the smaller ones where they're still out and about in the ocean before they really settle into the coastal
What are they
area.
Eating in the outside in the ocean?
They're eating
whatever they can.
They're usually on the surface and looking for smaller organisms at that point, yeah.
Yeah, and what's interesting to me is that they make it. Because they're small, you know, and they're small, they're up at the surface, which means that they are, there's food source for somebody else.
Yep, definitely.
Yeah.
So when these are small, you know, sometimes they may get eaten by sharks, but once they get past a certain size, the turtles have a much lower mortality rate. But it's really those first few years, especially when they're hatchlings, you know, they're
sure, you see them scrambling into the ocean and people have just eating them all up.
Exactly. You know? Even as they're leaving the nest, they're getting picked off by birds. And as soon as they enter the water, they're getting eaten by, fish. I've seen all these pictures of people that caught fish and they cut open their stomach.
And they're full of them.
Little hatchlings come out. And so, at the same time, they are also the turtles lay nests and hundreds of 100 eggs in a nest, and then they'll nest multiple times in a season, and they'll come back every few seasons.
But they
seasons.
Got to.
And
if,
so
what if they didn't?
Do.
We
and
wouldn't
so,
have any turtles. Yeah.
There's a balance to all of that.
Now here's the story. When you see one of these runs, you think, what's the conservation all about? Look, these things. There's a million of them. Well, they're not. Because I'm wondering if at the other end, when they become an adult and they're talking to each other, when one says, boy, we were the lucky ones. Look at how many we started at 2000. There's only you and me left. You know?
Well, yeah. Well, actually, that's a really good math, Mike, because the estimate right now is one in every 1,000 eggs or hatchlings.
Wow.
Out. So,
oh my goodness.
Good job.
Okay. So what other things differentiate loggerheads with some other turtles?
Let's see. I think for other things, what really separates the different turtle species is what they eat, mm-hmm. And where they're foraging. But otherwise, you know, they all start on land, mm-hmm. And they come back to the land to nest. The males usually stay in the water. You barely ever see them, you know, on land. But with loggerheads, the ones that we come across in the Hawaii longline mm-hmm. fishery, they're the North Pacific loggerheads.
Okay.
And so they're nesting all the way in Japan. And once they leave the nest, they start to cross the Pacific and come into the central North Pacific, just above Hawaii, several 100 miles north of Hawaii and further north. And that's where we see them.
How protected or endangered are the loggerheads?
So the loggerheads under the U.S. Endangered Species Act is designated an endangered species, so mm-hmm. not a threatened species. So that means endangered is the highest, the most endangered you can get on that scale. But the good news with loggerheads is over the last 20 years, the nesting numbers in Japan have been going up.
Are they or were they a food source in Japan? Are they no longer?
They were. Loggerheads were, especially after the war, there was a lot of egg harvest that went on, and that was a really important protein for them at that time.
Sure.
But then people started noticing that the numbers were declining. And in the 70s, a lot of the places where they were doing these egg harvests at that time prohibited it at the municipal level or the town level. And then they started the conservation. And I think that's what we're really seeing now is these loggerheads take 20 years to mature. So we're really just starting to see the fruits of that protection.
I think it's significantly important to note that, gang, is that it was probably a great reluctance that a lot of these people gave that up. I mean, it's a habit thing. If you go out and get the eggs, you go out and get the eggs. So there must have been some very good PR. And that must mean that in many respects, what we have to sell to members of the council and the fishermen, and also us that are fishermen ourselves or people that like to eat fish, is you got to understand there are rules for reasons. So that means that, okay, why all of a sudden are we caring all that much about a loggerhead?
Yeah, so what's happened in the Hawaii longline fishery, it's been a couple of things. I was on the show earlier this year talking a little bit about some of this too. Two things. One is that the last season, so the swordfish fishery, the swordfish targeting longline fishery, it usually has a season where they start around October, November, start to go out, and they really do most of their fishing between January and March, and then they start to taper off in the summer. So that's when I say a season. So this past season, towards the end of last year, we started seeing a lot more loggerhead turtle interactions in the swordfish fishery. Now, this is a fishery where we've had mitigation measures implemented. Mm-hmm. So we had much higher numbers back in the 90s. We put in circle hooks and macro bait, two things that really helped reduce the numbers by about 90%. And we were maintaining those lower numbers for a number of years until this past year, all of a sudden, boom, we saw a concentration of the interaction.
In spite of the mitigations that had been done before.
They're still using those
still
same
works.
Measures.
Yep,
and as far as we know, they still work. Mm-hmm. Nothing's changed on that front. But all of a sudden, boom, we had a spike. So that's something that really alerted us.
Yep.
The second thing is that there's been an outstanding lawsuit against the fishery, or technically, the National Marine Fisheries Service, or NOAA Fisheries, that has the responsibility of managing the turtle interactions.
Sure.
For this fishery.
Now, let's make sure that people understand what an interaction is. An interaction doesn't necessarily mean a death.
No. Yeah. And especially in the swordfish fishery, because they're fishing their gears a lot shallower than the tuna targeting, the hooks are at a depth where if a turtle gets caught, then it can still come up to the surface and breathe. Mm. And so nearly all of the interactions that we've seen in the shallow set, the swordfish fishery,
they end well.
The turtles come up, they're alive, they're brought on board and handled well, gear removed. Of course, there's an observer on board every single one of these swordfish boats. Every single trip, and so they're released alive.
Yeah.
So the interaction, the impact of the interaction over on the population is like to be limited, but it's something that we have to deal with because of the other laws that we follow, including the Endangered Species
Act. But, Asuka, I must tell you, that I'm actually, I know a couple of skippers and a couple of boat owners, and I'm actually, I admire them because they know they're doing this. If there were no observer, would they be doing it? I think yes. I think that, you know, a lot of these people are humans just like everybody else. They don't want to see some poor turtle die. And if it's not going out of their way too much, of course they're going to, especially on the retrieve, they're going to be able to take that thing on board carefully, address the hook that's in it somehow, remove it or cut it off where it can go away on its own or whatever, and then let it go.
Yeah, and I would hope that, you know, they do too. And you know, we know for sure on the swordfish fishery that they do because they do have the observers. But one of the things, the great things about the sea turtle mitigation measures that we have, the circle hook and macro bait, is it's such a simple measure that, you know, they had to change out the hooks once, but after that, you know, they buy the same hook and they stick with it. The bait too, once they switched over from squid to fish, then that's what they purchase. And so there's nothing much more that they really have to do to reduce that risk in the first place. And I think that's where you really want to focus on the mitigation.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, and that's why I wanted you to complete that thought, because I also wanted to ask that, you know, everybody, I know people are out there thinking, well, is there a big difference in the cost between the mackerel and the squid? One would think that the mackerel does not hold up as well as the squid does on a hook, and some of the other things that maybe people were reluctant. But what you're saying is no, that they are doing that. They are buying the other bait. They are doing the other hooks.
And those are both requirements. And we know from every single trip, we have records of what they're using. And so we know that there's 100% compliance.
Yeah, and that's pretty good. Now, for those that don't understand the reason, we already know that the longline fleet fishing out of Honolulu, the Hawaiian longline fleet, most of them are not fishing swords. Most of them are out fishing, you know, a big eye, or they're fishing tuna. Those that are fishing swords, they travel a lot further, don't they? And they actually, it's a different kind of fish. It's a different kind of fishing. So every trip, how did that happen? Every trip has an observer on it.
So that was and really a precautionary outcome from an earlier lawsuit that some folks will remember. The swordfish fishery was closed between 2001 and 2004. When the fishery reopened, that's when we required the circle hooks and the macro bait measures. But when that happened, the NOAA fishery said, well, why don't we monitor all of the boats and all of the trips and put observers on every single boat? And we can still do that because the swordfish sector is a much smaller. It's about a tenth of the fleet that actually goes swordfish fishing, and so we can still cover that. The tuna sector is, you know, observed at 20%. If we try to go 100% on every single one of them, that's going to be a big cost increase. But we can, you know, for the swordfish fishery, we've
now what happens when that happens, my friends, is the cost of the fish increases and the consumer pays more money, because somebody's got to pay for the, you know, what happens is, and we've talked about this before with others, and I don't know if we've talked with you, Asuka, about this, but you know, a boat owner, a company, they have to start weighing, do I really even want to be in this business anymore? I mean, you know, everything costs so much. So somebody has got to understand that when a cost is incurred, everybody pays.
Yeah, and I think, so the swordfish fishery used to be a lot bigger component of this longline fishery. And then because of that closure, a lot of the guys then switched over to tuna and stayed with tuna. And, you know, they're weighing the risks, right? They have all these turtle issues. And then the other thing that we have in place is this thing called hard cap, where if they reach a certain number, it closes down the swordfish fishery for the rest of the year.
Right.
And so they got to switch back to tuna. And so there's all these risks they have to weigh. And, you know, some of the folks may have decided not to go back to swordfish fishing because of those risks.
Now, for those that don't know, is it a big deal to change from one method to the other?
I understand that it takes about a day to switch out the gear.
You gotta switch out the gear.
They're not allowed to do that out at sea. Mm-hmm. So they'll have to be back at the port. They have to declare which type they're going to do before they go, so that the observers know how to place the observers.
Once again, we are way more monitored here in Hawaii than in other places.
Absolutely. So it's a decision that they can make, and some boats do. All of the boats tuna fish, and then of those, about a tenth of them will also go swordfish fishing sometime in the year.
And you'd wonder why they do that. Well, let me tell you, there's a number of reasons. First of all, the fish travels very well. It is the preferred fish in some places, particularly the back east. Swordfish is a very, very hearty, good source of protein, and it is really a pretty neat fish. But what I think is interesting, maybe from a scientific standpoint, you know, most of our sword boats that came here came from the Atlantic seaboard, when that fishery literally fished itself out years ago. Isn't that right?
Yeah, I think some of them came from the East Coast, and there's a contingent that came from the Gulf as well.
Sure.
But I think some of those were tuna boats. But yeah, so we had that influx of longline boats that came in the late 80s, and that's when the council really started getting into the longline management. We saw the growth. We put the limit on the number of vessels that can be part of this fishery, and that system is still in place. And so the council was really early on recognize the importance of managing this fishery, and we've been able to maintain this fishery despite a lot of the challenges that it's faced.
Yeah, and what I must tell you, gang, is I've looked at this, and we've talked to a lot of people in Nantucket and the Eastern Seaboard and some Gulf, that at one point in time, this is two decades ago, the average size of the sword being caught was about 400 pounds, and they went way down to under 100, and that's when literally... Didn't they say literally the sword fishery collapsed on the? So that means all of these people that want to earn a living started looking for somewhere else, but they got into the Pacific and restrictions started right away, which is probably what, don't you think, maintains our ability to even still catch that fish at any weight.
And in the swordfish that our fishery targets is doing well.
Yeah.
It's not overfished. Overfishing isn't occurring. The stock is healthy. And so that's, you know, there's a lot more potential for fishing, but some of these turtle issues do sometimes get in the way. So we try to balance that and look for ways that we can balance catching the turtles while saving catching the swordfish while saving the turtles. Let me get that straight. Because this is a very important fishery.
Yeah.
Even though it's only a tenth of the boats that go out, this fishery produces nearly half of the swordfish, U.S. domestic swordfish production every year.
Yeah, so and by the way, everybody, I remember my friend Naka asked me, said, you know, I was listening to your show, and you guys keep talking about the swordfish, and I didn't realize until you were through it several times that we're talking shutomi, that a lot of people don't call it swordfish, and a lot of people in Japan, for instance, it's shutomi, and but that's the fish. There's something magic about it, isn't it? The way it travels, and I think mainly some of the upper end restaurants really love it because it's firm, it's solid, and it can be cooked in a number of ways with a number of sauces.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, it truly is delicious. Okay, but let's get back to the thing that you like, and that is, once again, the turtle part. When you say mackerel baits, why is mackerel less desirable to the turtles, or what?
So what we found is that the research found that when there's a squid on the hook versus a fish on the hook, the turtles get caught less, not because they're less attracted, but because of the way that they end up eating the bait off of the hook. Whereas the squid, they can't really bite the thing off, and so they end up taking the whole thing, and when they do,
they get the hook. Yeah, yeah.
Whereas the fish, they have the ability, they can chew off the fish.
And they're so smart.
They're a little difference in that feeding behavior is really what makes the difference.
You know, when you talk about, when we talked last week about birds. Birds are, they can be dive bombing, they can come in, they're fairly fast, they're accurate. It seems to me that a turtle has more trouble foraging because it's not exactly a speed demon. You know, they're very, very slow. So they have to go find stuff to eat that's very, very slow. What amazes me is when these longline boats are setting, is that the only time that's slow? Because that's not slow either. They gotta get those hooks out, they're moving pretty fast.
Yeah, but once the longline gear is in the water, then
it
stays. Yeah. So that's when we don't know exactly what part of the soak that they're getting caught, probably all throughout. Whenever they have an opportunity, they come across it, they go after it. So, you know, we don't quite know, but, you know, they have an opportunity to go off to it and actually munch on it because the gear remains relatively static once it's in the water.
Yeah, now that being said, I know the set varies from boat to boat, and the distance in between the hooks varies. One would think that the word would get out among the turtle gang, okay, there's a whole bunch of food over here. So that must mean they just swim the length of the set as long as it sets in the water. But it's not in the water that long.
Well, Well, actually, sunfish is a little longer. Yeah,
than
several hours at least. Mm-hmm. And it depends. But with turtles, we're not quite sure if they're actually communicating with each other. Mm-hmm. And we don't usually see, or we don't think there's a behavior of them going down the line. We definitely think that that's happening with marine mammals like false killer whales. Mm-hmm. But with turtles, we think it's a little bit more opportunistic. They come across it. They have one. They haven't quite learned to go down.
But what's interesting to me, just as a slight diversion, is quite often when there's a set, if you catch fish right away, you don't know about those fish that are that have been captured that are on the first part of the set, because you're quite far away from them. However, the big predators, they are not after the mackerel. They're after the fish that the mackerel has been eaten by, right? So they're actually after the big eye or the shutomi or whatever they can eat.
Yeah, so the false killer whale issue is definitely a catch. You know, they're coming after the catch, the big fish. They also do go after the bait, we know that. And then there's also, you know, shark depredation too. The catch that they bring in, sometimes, you know, they bring up a fish that's already been half eaten by sharks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, now, but I think what people need to know is, without dazzling them by numbers, which is a world that you live in, when we talk about this number of interactions, number of taking, of killing, that's a smaller number. I mean, but what I'm wondering is, why is there the concern about this? I mean, why is this an issue? Because it seems to be a static number for a long time. Has there also been an increase, like we talked about last week, in the bird interactions? Has there been an increase in the loggerheads?
Yeah, so the increase really, the big increase really happened this past season. Up to that point, we had seen no more than 17 in an entire year.
In a whole year.
And again, this is the exact number since we have the observers on board. What happened in 2017, we ended up with 21.
Mm-hmm.
This year, we ended up with 33. And I say ended up, even though it's not the end of the
calendar year. But it's almost the end of the
fishery is closed right now because of that lawsuit issue.
Right.
The lawsuit ended up getting a decision made at Ninth Circuit Court that ended up in a settlement, and then that ended up closing the fishery this year in mid-May, even though the fishery was still one below the hard cap. So the hard cap this year was 34. They ended up having to close the fishery at 33. Mm-hmm. But it was quite an anomaly for us to see something that high. And one of the things that was really unique this year in that interaction was there was really a concentration in that interaction in December and January. Some patterns that we saw that we really hadn't seen, because usually these interactions happen sporadically throughout the year. We'll see one here, one there. This year, it was a concentration. It was, you know, the half of the boats that were out there were encountering turtles one way or another. And then we also saw a smaller number of the trips that had really high number of turtles that we also never saw before since 2004. And so what, and then the captains were coming back saying, there's a lot of turtles out there.
I was going to say, from what I heard, I spoke to some of the captains. They said, you know, it was a bumper year for a lot of things, including turtle sightings. I mean, sometimes, even when they're motoring, when they have no intention of doing a set because they're going to a set of numbers that they want to put their line out, they see turtles on the surface and say, hey, wait a minute, this is like a lot.
Yeah, so what we do know, and we don't know if we can say it's a direct correlation yet, because our science center partners are really diving into this now, is that, you know, we were talking about the loggerhead turtle numbers in Japan going up.
Mm-hmm.
You're
talking about population going up, right?
The nesting numbers going up, right? And so there was a big uptick that started in 2008. That's 10 years ago. Now, we're talking the size of the turtles that are getting caught are, you know, relatively small, maybe a foot, foot and a half.
So these are juveniles.
Loggerhead turtles. But when they start getting into the foot, foot and a half, they're like 6 to 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So you start doing the math and saying, okay, well, the population really spiked up in 2008 in Japan. That's the nesting numbers. Those are the hatching numbers going up. And so now we're starting to see
now you're seeing the fruits of that group.
Year, you know, size classes in our fishery all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. go up. And so there, that's one of the possibilities. The other possibility, too, is that loggerhead turtles are pretty temperature associated. Mm-hmm. And so there's a temperature band
at which there's a
higher number of interactions, although it also happens to be a higher concentration where they're fishing. So that makes it a little bit tricky. But what we also saw was that temperature band where those interactions happened, that was pretty compressed in that time. And so one of the possibilities, too, is that there's one more turtles out there, but there's also that those turtles were much more concentrated because their preferred habitat was concentrated.
What's interesting to me on that, Asuka, is that these two animals don't have much to do with each other. Like the swordfish don't care about the turtles, and I'm sure the turtles don't care about the swordfish, but they're in the same same locale. So the commonality must be bait.
Yeah.
I
think it's the whatever the environmental condition of they're eating, right? Where they're feeding tends to overlap. So one of the things that, and so we saw those increases. The council was already starting to look at those turtle, the way that we manage the turtle interactions, especially with respect to the hard cap, those limits, whether we still need those, if they're still useful. And so the council ended up going in March and June looking at, in light of this higher interactions, to see if there's some simple ways to keep these numbers down while making sure the fishery continues to operate. Because this fishery provides half of the U.S. swordfish.
Yeah, and that's really an important thing for you to know.
And that's important for the council to consider, too. And so what the council ended up doing in June was to say, well, because of this higher interactions that we had, this hard cap, this fleet-wide cap that says, let's close the fishery when we reach this number, can be useful. But at the same time, we also want to have some other controls in place where we have an early warning system. So if we have a limit of 34, we didn't have any other warning system in place to let the vessels know that they're getting close or we're seeing a higher concentration of these. And so one of the easy ways that the council figured out to do it, looking at the pattern of the interactions we saw this past year, was that higher number of interactions and small number of the trips.
Okay.
And so we focused on that. And then the council decided to put a limit on the number of turtle interactions per trip. And so that way, if there's an individual boat out there that's starting to see two turtles in a trip, three turtles in a trip, they know that they also have a limit. They're getting close to that. And if they reach that limit, they're going to have to come back to port regardless of what point they're at in their trip. So if they're on set five when they were planning to be out there for 15 sets and they have to come back because of the turtle interactions, that gives them an additional incentive, an individual incentive to figure out, I really got to avoid turtles at this point. And so that's something that the council recommended doing. We're in the process of implementing that, but we're also waiting on some additional analysis.
Okay, as a fisherman, I really get it. And I think that most of our audience does. And gang, every time we get a chance to have Asuka Ishizaki here, we learn something. As a fisherman, I'm saying, look, if this thing called an interaction results in this turtle being released and unharmed, why are we bothering about this? Why is the pressure on? Well, obviously, it must mean that there are others in the ocean that pay no attention to these rules, and they're not releasing anything. They're killing stuff.
And that's been a frustration for this fishery for sure.
Yeah.
Especially, for this fishery, it is because of the Endangered Species Act, and we operate within the U.S. But it's also been because it's been the focus of so many lawsuits over the years. It's always under scrutiny. And so there's a higher stake here and a pressure to continue to do more.
Yeah.
Our scientists on the council, the scientific committee that advises the council, asked that same question. Biologically, you are not doing an impact here, so why even have a limit? Because a limit itself...
It's limiting,
and it's also not tied to the biological number right now either. It's based on a number that we've seen in the past. So they were raising some questions too, but we're going to have to work on that long term and see what we can do within the limits of the Endangered Species Act and see how we can balance that.
I think the important takeaway would be that, you may not agree with the fact that they do the closure. And I do know that if you are a a restaurant in Michigan that features swordfish, you don't want to be told that, you know, you can't buy anymore. Because what they're going to do is they're going to go look for some other fish. And they may or may not return to buying swordfish next time, which is threatening the fleet's ability to sell its catch.
I think that's very important to be for this fishery to be able to provide swordfish and to be able to have the U.S. source of swordfish. In order to do that, they have to be able to deliver when they're expected to deliver in the season that, you know, works best for them.
Yeah, but one thing you did say earlier, and it bears repeating, is that the scientific community, you all, you notice this uptick. And the uptick was significant. So you said that some of it might be explained that they're just this bigger batch of turtles coming of age and being out there. And so obviously the numbers are going to increase. But what happened in June of this year that we should know about?
So the council, that's when the council made the recommendation to keep the hard cap and also to...
At 34.
Actually, it's a newer number than that, but it's a similar number. And then to add the individual trip limit. So that's a new provision that the council recommended. The number then is right now, the council recommended some preliminary numbers. That's going to be tied to another document called the biological opinion, which is an analysis prepared under the Endangered Species Act. So we don't have a whole lot of control over that. So we're waiting on that document to be completed. Yeah. If the numbers are still consistent with that document, then the council can go with that. The council will be reviewing that document when it becomes available. Originally, the draft was supposed to be available in October 1. We're starting to hear that it's going to be a little bit delayed further. The council will review it when it's available and then revisit those recommendations if needed and then move forward from there.
This is very interesting, gang, because it's like if you were with us last week when we're talking about talking about birds. A lot of these studies and a lot of these things, they take so long to put in place. But the big important thing to know is that there are some responsible skippers that will say, okay, pull them in. We're going to go somewhere else. There's just too many turtles here. Because they realize they may not be hurting themselves for that trip, but they're hurting their competitors and they're hurting themselves to have the season shortened if you know that there are turtles there and you set your lines anyway.
Yeah, and that's what we saw this season, especially once we got into January and we continued to see more loggerhead turtles. And the numbers were racking up pretty quick. One of the things that we discovered is that, unfortunately, those numbers, the real-time numbers that we were getting at the council and the NOAA fisheries were getting, those numbers were not getting back to the fleet. And so it took us calling the folks in the fleet saying, hey, do you know these numbers are going up really fast? So we realized that there's a fleet communication improvement that could be made, and we're working with the industry right now to develop something so that they can get that information quick without also... one of the issues was the confidentiality of the information, right? Because you don't want to reveal where the boat is, because you don't want to reveal your exact fishing spot.
That's always a
big concern. But we want to also be able to let them know if there's a lot of turtles interactions and happening when the rest of the fleet, folks should know that. And so we're trying to balance that information and work with the industry to develop.
Yeah, unfortunately, what Asuka is talking about, and you see this all the time, where boats don't want to share their numbers or where they are. You can say, well, give me a grid. Well, even a greenhorn skipper can know if you give a grid, you can still find them. But the ocean is blocked off in some major places. So I think it's a credit to the fleet and to the individual captains when they say, hey, you know what? There's too many turtles here. Let's just go. Let's go a couple hundred miles over there.
And that's what, you know, definitely happened when they found out that these numbers were racking up pretty fast. They started calling the owners on shore, started calling the captains and letting them know, and got some of those boats out of there. And that definitely slowed the numbers. And that's probably why they did stay open until May. So there really is an interest in the fleet to make sure, you know, these numbers do help in keeping the fleet alert. What we want to do is make sure that that number is fair. There's ways to keep the fishery reopen.
I was going to say, what is that? What are the next step in doing that?
Yeah, so the we're really looking to the individual trip limit as a new measure to help that out. Mm-hmm. So that'll be tested over the next, you know, once it's implemented, we'll see how it works. We'll see how the fishery responds, monitor that information every year. And if we see some unexpected behavior come out of that, we'll respond to that again. It's another one of those, you know, iterative processes where we get the information, we make a decision, we monitor it, we learn from that, and if we need to make modifications, we'll go back in. And that's
and that'd be a great way to leave it. And I want to tell you that a lot of this information that we share, it ends up eventually being available to you for any number of things. Particularly if you're a teacher, you want to know more about this, wpcouncil.org is where you go. They have a myriad of information on all parts of the fishery, including these reports. And if you're somebody that's putting together a business plan and you've been thinking about buying a longline boat, you've been thinking about becoming a fisherman, you want to think twice, number one. But number two, you want to make sure that you are privy to this information. It's readily available, and the council loves it when you get some. Masuka, nice seeing you, and thanks
for
being
me.
This again. Okay, we'll see you next week. Meantime, if you'd like to hear something on Go Fish, you know what to do. Drop me a line, themikebuckshow@gmail.com. themikebuckshow@gmail.com. In the meantime, catch a lot of fish. Save some for me. Aloha.